Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Gerald Harris, Chair of the Club's Science and Technology Member-Led Forum, and your host for today. We welcome our listening audience, and we invite anyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. Now, it is my pleasure to introduce Jacqueline Omotolade and her panel of experts on open space and clean and climate change. Her speakers include Elizabeth Goldstein, President of the California Parks Foundation, Cindy Schaefer, Natural Resource Program Manager, Bay Area District of California Parks, Anthony Khalil, Community Program Manager, Candlestick Point, Echo Stewarts, Mark Holmes, the Bay Institute, David Bupre, Port of San Francisco, and Marie Harrison, Community Organizer for Green Action. Please welcome Jackie.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you so much for showing up this evening to talk about something that is near and dear to me, which is climate resiliency and how we protect San Francisco. My name is Jackie Amotolade, and I am the director of the Blue Greenway at the San Francisco Parks Alliance. I'd like to thank all of these amazing panelists who have come here today. I've been at the Parks Alliance now for almost a year, and I have had the pleasure of working with each of these individuals who are definitely experts in their own right on climate change, on sea level rise, on open space, and on the Southeast waterfront. So I look forward to hearing their presentations today. I would also like to give a shout out to my boss, the CEO of the San Francisco Parks Alliance, Matthew O'Grady, who is in the audience. Thank you so much for all your support and all the work that our organization does to support parks and open space in San Francisco. So to begin with, let me just situate you on the project that I work on, which is called the Blue Greenway. And the Blue Greenway is an effort that starts at AT&T Park and moves south along the waterfront of San Francisco through Candlestick State Park to connect residents of the southeast and of San Francisco as a whole to the waterfront in ways that they haven't had access before. So what does that mean? That means a 13.1-mile bike lane supported by a necklace of parks and open space. And what role does the Parks Alliance play in it? Well, as I initially indicated, the Parks Alliance, our whole mission is to inspire and promote civic engagement and philanthropy to protect, sustain, and enrich San Francisco parks, recreation, and green open spaces. And we are, the San Francisco Parks Alliance, playing a major role in coordinating all the government entities, private developers, nonprofits, and other entities around promoting this Blue Greenway space. And with that, I will take it to the largest landowner along the waterfront, which is the Port of San Francisco. David?
Thanks, Jackie. Again, I'm David Bilpre. I'm a planner with the Port of San Francisco. The Port of San Francisco's jurisdiction is from Heron's Head Park on the south to Aquatic Park on the north.
David, just speak into the microphone a little bit.
Aquatic Park to the north. Does that help? Is that better? The Port is a public enterprise committed to promoting a balance of maritime, recreational, industrial, transportation, public access, and commercial activities on a self-supporting basis. It is directed by a 5-member commission appointed by the mayor of San Francisco. And so briefly, what I thought I would do is run through what the Blue Greenway is. So this image shows the city and the water. The green dots are the parks. The trail or pathways and streets and walkways are what connect the parks. So they're the necklace that connects the parks. The blue represents the water landings for access into the bay, the Bay Area Water Trail. And then the water trail is illustrated with the blue connection between them. So you add them all together, and that equates the Blue Greenway, which is a city project, to complete the Bay Trail and Bay Area Water Trail, which is a 9-county, 600-mile visioned open space system to encircle the bay. So this illustrates it on an aerial photograph of southeast San Francisco with the port. Could you go back one? With the port, what I'm going to talk about are two specific projects. One, the Pier 70 area, which is illustrated on the north or on the right-hand side, and then the Piers 80 through 96 area illustrated on the left-hand side. Next. So this area shows the Pier 70 site plan. It's about a 65-acre site that the port spent 3 years developing a community-driven preferred master plan for the site that had five goals. One, retain the ship repair operations, an important port mission and important job generator to the city. Establish a National Register Historic District. This Pier 70 area is now a National Register Historic District. It's the longest continually operating civilian shipyard in the United States, has built and repaired ships here since the Spanish-American War or since Abraham Lincoln was in office. Create a system of waterfront open spaces illustrated in green. Allow new infill development, which is illustrated in the various colors. And do environmental cleanup and develop this project entirely using sustainable practices. The up on the northern part of the project, next, hit the slide. I'm going to just briefly go over Crane Cove Park, which is one of the first projects we have underway there. Go ahead, next. As it relates to sea level rise and climate action, what's illustrated, click again, here is the site. If we did nothing, the site would be entirely flooded in 2100. During peak flood periods, and at mean high water, about half the site would be covered. Next slide. As a part of developing our park plan, what our strategy is to develop infrastructure that supports park programming, remediates the environmental contamination from 150 years of industrial operation, and allows the bay to reclaim some of the land itself. So when the park is constructed, there'll be impacts to the park from sea level rise, but it's being impacted in a way that we can maintain and manage it. Next. This shows one of the shoreline approaches where we're actually allowing the bay to reclaim the site on a phase two part of the park, kind of in slipways 1, 2, and 3. Next. This shows an overall site plan that really shows how we integrate the history of the site, the water of the site, and the program of the site. The other thing that I didn't mention is two of the improvements are there's a historic slipway that kind of runs in the middle of the site that's being retained, and we're allowing sea level to rise and reclaim up into the slipway and programming the park to allow that to happen and recognize it and educate and interpret it. And then on the northern part of the park, we're actually taking out former small boat building concrete ways and creating a new urban beach that will accommodate human-powered boating and aquatic center, and raising the site again to elevate it to protect the city and the neighborhood from sea level rise. Next. Then the next area I wanted to talk about is what we call our Piers 80 through 96 Maritime Eco-Industrial Center. And what both of these plans are trying to illustrate is that there's a balance of providing new open space to support the communities that they're within, but also maintaining the important maritime and industrial uses that are out there. And so what's illustrated here is on the north is Pier 80, where we have a cargo terminal, and Piers 90 through 96. And in green, if you can see it on the slide, are various open spaces that are adapting and allowing public access in nature. So down in this area, we have an open space system on Islay's Creek. We have the Pier 94 wetlands, that's habitat. And we have, just off the screen to the south, Heron's Head Park. What the port defines as an eco-industrial center is an area that co-locates industrial uses to enable product exchange, optimize uses of resources, incorporate green design and green technologies on site, fosters resource recovery and reuse, to provide economic opportunities that employ local residents, minimize environmental impacts, and incorporate public access for enjoyment and the habitat. A big mouthful, but really what it is, this area in particular, is there's a number of jobs that are generated for the community, high-paying jobs that are for the Bayview community. We work with the community in making certain that all of our tenants hire from within it, but then we also integrate open space with it. So next slide. So here's one of our major parks, Heron's Head Park. You can see it in the middle. You can see what it looked like at the beginning, back before the park was built, where it was just fill. And then a program that we operate with Recreation and Parks Department, our partner, called Greenagers, where we employ and educate youth within the community to teach them about sustainable practices.
And lastly, each of our projects goes through a number of public community meetings. For Crane Cove Park, just as an example, these are all the meetings we went through in 3-year time frame. We had over 30 community meetings to make certain that the community was fully engaged in getting what at the end they'll want. That concludes my presentation. Thanks.
Thank you very much, David. And I can attest, David, I have called on David numerous times for community tours, and he has always been ready and willing with the keys to Pier 70 and other piers to let people in and really explain and go into detail all the work that the pier is doing, the port is doing in keeping San Francisco safe. So next up, we have Mark, who I actually sent an email to maybe 6 months into my job, very randomly. Hey, can you meet with me and talk with me about wetlands? And we actually ended up meeting for lunch and chatting for about, 3 or 4 hours. So Mark, Bay Institute.
Thank you. Is that my first slide?
Yes.
Not the one I sent, but we can fake it. So what you're looking at is a map of San Francisco Bay before anybody settled here. It looks really nothing like today. What you see is over 500,000 acres in green of tidal marshes that existed before European colonization of the area that are fundamentally all gone today. We filled the shallow margins of the bay. 92% of the San Francisco Bay wetlands are gone. All of the Delta wetlands are gone. And what we're left with is the map that we all recognize today from Google Earth. But that's only about 2/3 of the San Francisco Bay that remains. This is our familiar map of San Francisco Bay. Because those shallow lands were very easy to fill, they were reclaimed manually initially and then reclaimed by diking them mechanically. We have more miles of levee holding back the Pacific Ocean in San Francisco Bay than does the entire nation of Holland to hold back the North Sea. It's been a major transformation of the estuary, and it also is coming into play now as we face rising sea level at a very accelerated rate in a way that I'll describe briefly. These are the wetlands of San Francisco Bay. We've now zoomed in 200,000 acres of tidal wetlands that were diked and drained and converted in the following manner. What you're looking at is a 1924 photo looking north towards San Bruno Mountain with the fog bank over San Francisco. There's a dirt road there that will become Highway 101, and the diking and draining of the tidal marshes of Brisbane has begun in earnest to create an airfield that will be called Mills Field. Eventually, all of those wetlands will be filled, all the open water that you see here, all the mudflats, and it will be San Francisco International Airport as we know it today. The impact of that destruction of the shallow margins of the bay has been cataclysmic on bay wildlife and habitat, but it's also left us without any shoreline protection between the open waters of the bay and the developed shoreline. Those marshes, in fact, reduced storm surge, reduced storm wave height and storm energy. That we call them horizontal levees because of the benefit that they provided for protecting the shoreline. And as you saw from the past map, there was a horseshoe ring around them from San Bruno Mountain all the way around South Bay up to Oakland of approximately 60,000 acres in the South Bay alone. So here's the map today. The colored areas are former tidal wetlands. In dark brown in the North Bay was converted to agricultural lands, hayfield. In the South Bay, you see the pink or salmon-colored lands. 30,000 of acres that were converted to solar salt evaporation ponds. In purple around San Francisco, you see San Francisco International Airport and Crissy Field, of course, was filled. And the downtown financial district, the shoreline came up to Montgomery Street originally. Portsmouth Square was actually located on the shoreline, not where it is today, several blocks from the shoreline. And Islas Creek, as was mentioned, and Mission Bay. Mission Bay was actually the major ship building and whaling station and fishing industry location in San Francisco Bay, all gone. limited channels that remain today. The strategy for adapting to sea level rise, and this is on a regional scale, is to breach the dikes and restore those tidal wetlands and let the vegetation grow again in order to reduce storm surge, because in the near term, and that is for the next 50 years, the biggest threat to flooding on the shoreline will be from storms during the winter, during El Nino years and on high tides, not from static sea level rise. Hmm. So we can talk more about this in the session. Thank you very much.
Okay. Up next, we have Cindy from the California State Parks.
Thank you. Thrilled to be here at the Commonwealth Club discussing a topic that is important to all of us. Climate change and climate resiliency are at the forefront of state parks planning and resource management. As the manager of more than 300 miles of the California coastline, state parks is uniquely positioned to play a leading role in coastal protection by proactively evaluating and planning for the effects of sea level rise. Researchers have projected that sea levels along the California coast will increase by as much as 66 inches over the next century, and parks like Candlestick are already experiencing impacts. Next slide. These photos show some of the shoreline erosion currently occurring at Candlestick. Shoreline impacts from storm surge and wave energy are already an issue at Candlestick and will only get worse under climate change. To address sea level rise, State Parks has developed a sea level rise guidance document that provides information and resources to identify, document, and manage vulnerabilities early in the project management and planning process. The document outlines a process for evaluating the potential effects of flooding and inundation on park resources and state park projects. All projects in coastal and bay units are now evaluated for their sustainability to sea level rise. This map is from the Candlestick Point General Plan, which was finalized in January 2013. The planning process included three public meetings and public outreach via mailings and websites. This map shows in pink the projected flood zone with 3 feet of sea level rise. The planning process for the park factored in climate change and sea level rise and recommended an adaptive management approach to deal with sea level rise. In some locations, adding fill to those areas to increase the elevation of a site in the park may be the recommended approach for preserving park facilities and visitor access. And in other areas, retreating and letting sea level rise take its course may be the appropriate action. For example, in the upper right corner, right there, the narrow strip of land between the main core area of the park and the point will be flooded with 3 feet of sea level rise. And this could create an island out of the point, which could result in subsequent construction of a bridge for visitor access. So that's one example. Can you go back to the prior slide? Thank you. Also, looking back at these photos of shoreline erosion, the plan recommends using an adaptive management approach for addressing shoreline erosion, including natural soft shorelines and living shorelines where possible, where the waters are calmer, as well as engineered structural reinforcements where necessary. Okay, go forward in the next one. Thank you. As State Park's first urban park, Candlestick is uniquely positioned to help play a role in climate change mitigation and adaptation for the local community around it. I'm sure some members of the audience have heard about the urban heat island effect. It's often hotter in cities where there's all the asphalt and concrete than it is in wooded or grassy areas. Trees and other vegetation in parks not only provide shade, but they also turn sunlight into food, reducing the amount of heat absorbed and reflected from built surfaces. So parks also provide an escape from the heat on a hot summer day. Last slide. A quick wrap-up. This map shows the future vision for Candlestick as outlined in the general plan. There's going to be a lot of change in coming years with expanded beaches, marshes, and new areas for community gathering and recreational activity. For those interested, there is a more detailed conceptual plan version of this map in the final general plan, which is available on the State Parks website. Thank you.
Thank you. And now up next, looks like we have Elizabeth.
Good evening. I'm going to talk a little bit about the particular project that the California State Parks Foundation has been working on. The department approached us many years ago and asked whether or not we would be willing to take a portion of the park. Please, one more slide back. Sorry. Nope, the other direction. There we go. An area of the park that was acquired when the park was first, the sites were being accumulated for the park, but effectively remained a vacant lot and inaccessible to the public. So we agreed to take on initially a feasibility study to look at this portion of the park and to really say, what are the things that the community wants from it? What are the things that the department wants from it? And how might it be converted into a useful piece of open space for the community? And one of the things that we heard over and over and over again in that process was that the cleanup of the site itself, which was a residual, had a lot of toxic pockets in it and had a series of buildings on it that were industrial and largely abandoned, was the first priority of the community. That really getting this site to a place where it was a clean contributor to the community was absolutely vital. And in many ways, that restoration goal of the site was the highest, most important thing that we heard over and over again. The next was access to recreational facilities. And so what we did was, based on the community's input, and you can show me the next slide, thank you, Jackie, is that we really wanted to create an upland portion that both responded to the more natural environment there. So we took the site that you saw and we carved out two significant wetland bays and, in fact, did a toxic remediation of the entire site. This phase of the project is complete. This was phase one of the project. And we're currently working on phase two of the project, which will actually allow the public, it's all of the park-like improvements to the site, including small interpretive center, classrooms, both indoor and outdoor for the public, the connections of the Bay Trail through the site for biking and walking, as well as places where the community can come a picnic, throw a ball around with their children, all the things that people normally do in parks. So all of the park improvements themselves are phase two of this project. And then phase three will ultimately be an equivalent on the south side of Yosemite Slough. In all, we will be spending approximately $28 million, largely private funds that we've raised, and we will have created a 34-acre addition to the existing portions of Candlestick State Recreation Area, and have allowed the public essentially to get access to a piece of property that's been owned by the public for more than 40 years. And we are very excited about this project, and we are very close to our next stages of it. We hope to be in construction for phase two, that is the public amenities of the park, this summer. Knock on wood. And we anticipate that the park will actually be open to the public in the fall of 2017, which will be the first time, as I said, that the public has actually accessed this newly cleaned, newly designed, newly refurbished park space. We actually, and you can go to the next slide here. We actually did take a look at the impacts, the potential impacts of sea level rise at this site, and have indeed, as Cindy alluded to, come up with a management approach. Because there's no place to go back, there's no room to move back, we have to manage sea level rise within the site. And so what we're proposing to do is to use the wetlands and adapt them over time as sea level rise happens. And we've deliberately designed the public portions of the park at a higher grade than the wetlands themselves to allow for that adaptation. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And now we have one of my favorite community organizers, who was, when I started working in the Bayview Hunters Point area, they said, Marie Harrison is the woman you have to go to and talk to. So Marie, you're up.
Oh, good. Well, let me apologize. Some kind of way my slides didn't get to you, but we did send them. But I guess the easiest way to explain to you what I do, I'm a community organizer and educator. My job is to connect all of the dots for everything that they've done or that they're about to do and prepare the community for those things happening and to assure that they are done safely. I mean, I have to be responsible for looking out for subsistence fishers that we still have going on in the Bayview Hunters Point and actually throughout the city around our water's edge. I have to look out for areas where I know that they are underground leaking storage tanks, the work that's going on in the shipyard and what's leaching into the bay, the work that's going on around Yosemite Slough, how they're doing it, how they're going to protect the community as well as the water when they start to dredge and clean the contaminated sludge from it. Then what are they going to do with it once they dig it up? Where they're going to send it to? I jokingly said I work throughout California, and that's not a joke. I do. I can be found almost anywhere from Los Angeles all the way back, and I'm never there when you expect for me to be there. I am jokingly called the hammer. I'm the person that takes the community's information, their wants and their desires, and I'm the one standing in your face hammering it on your heads that this is what's going to happen. It's going to cost a little bit of extra, but this is what's going to happen. And being a very short woman in a tall people's world, so I'm told, little people don't take no very well, so I'm a pain in their asses. I'm sorry. I have no other way to say that. So, having said that, one of the things that I do in particular is I put together a presentation on sea level rise. I had to make it so that the community itself would understand it. And so when I did my first one, we do a series of what we call leadership academies. My first one was a mixed audience. It was 8 people that were aged all the way from 17 to 54. My second one was just straight out of high school. My third one was all college students. All of these academies, the information was sorted and gathered and put together in different ways because I needed to see what would be the most effective. I'm about to do a fourth leadership academy through San Francisco. And I'm going to use people that have already had some experience working with, that has some working knowledge, because they need to be prepared to be the leaders on this. They need to step in. It's not always easy to make a phone call to Marie and say, did you know this was going on, or are you going to look at this? They need to understand that now it's their turn. So that was one of the reasons for going from one extreme age-wise to the other extreme age-wise, because I have discovered that even with my seniors, that they can be the best watchdogs in the world, and they are, trust me, they're very, very intelligent, and they work very hard. But in taking that information, I had to decide how to give it to the community folks. And it's too long for 30 seconds, so what I'm going to tell you is that in the first part of my process, I do the simple thing. What is sea level rise? What does it mean to you in your community? Why is it a threat? What happens to the sea around the edges of the water when they start to dredge and dig? What's happening with the toxic soup that's underneath Parcel E as it is being leached? It's being broken down and leaching out into the bay. A lot of folks don't realize that the Navy owns 100 yards of the water, but the water is so smart, it does not stop at that 100 yards and mix, and not mix with other water. And I'll leave it at that.
And finally, last but not least,
hey,
we have Mr. Anthony Khalil, who is also working in Candlestick.
Yeah. It's real good to be here with you all tonight. Good evening. Anthony Khalil again, Community Programs Manager with Literacy for Environmental Justice. And our organization has been based in southeastern San Francisco, Bayview Hunters Point, for close to 20 years now. I've been with the organization since 2004, and we have been pondering this deep ecological question since our inception on how do we adapt to climate change, but yet how do we prepare? So that's the strategies that I want to kind of demystify within the green blur of San Francisco. We are here in one of the greenest cities, and today I want to kind of invoke the spirit of another city being Mardi Gras, okay? So we're going to let the good times roll, but there's a lot of work to do. I want to play this clip, and then we're going to get into some of the strategies on how a community-based organization prepares for something that, as Naomi Klein coined in her book, which I really encourage folks to read, this changes everything. We're going to play this clip.
These Bay Area teenagers are getting their hands dirty and helping restore this fragile Bay Area shoreline.
Yosemite Slough was once a beautiful creek that made its way from McLaren Park in southeast San Francisco down to the bay here in the Bayview Hunters Point community.
The once thriving wetland just north of Candlestick Park is best known as home to a naval shipyard and the site of illegal dumping. But these eco-stewards want to turn that around.
The State Parks Foundation has been funding their presence at Candlestick Point to help with the restoration, as well as to give opportunities for neighborhood youth to become involved with nature and learn more about nature.
Volunteers collect native plant seeds and nurture seedlings at this community garden.
I actually live in a housing project right next door, and I never knew that this existed.
When completed, this patch of land will be the largest contiguous wetland in San Francisco County.
We're not just restoring habitat, we're not just, you know, fixing nature, we're also fixing people's way of thinking towards nature.
Learning life lessons while bringing nature back to the bay.
We just saw an opportunity to, you know, to make something out of it, which we did.
People have the right to live in a clean, healthy, and just world, and ecological restoration is part of that picture.
Thank you very much. So, you know, rather than sit here and kind of demystify these strategies on how we prepare for climate change, I'll talk about what our organization has done and what we intend to do. Based right here in southeastern San Francisco, a lot of our talk has been kind of taking the macro picture of the region, with David starting us looking at the Blue and Greenway, the largest open space project in San Francisco. That's a huge impact. But the context of that also is in the largest redevelopment ever to hit the city from AT&T Park to here. It has extreme ecological, or as we call it, eco-social impacts. What Ledge or Candlestick Point Eco Stewards Project has done for the past 2 decades almost is, first off, understand the value of ecosystem services as natural buffers, as Mark was explaining how we've, as a human species, have transformed this Bay Estuarine habitat, but impacts vulnerable communities, a.k.a. communities of color, working class communities, basically southeastern San Francisco, disproportionately. How we engage in urban greening is one of our strategies around the green infrastructure and ensuring those ecosystem services do exist, especially in the most vulnerable populations. I want to, you know, share out more, but going back to what I was explaining about New Orleans, 10 years ago last year was the biggest lesson on what our neighborhoods have to do in regards to preparing for climate change and who receives those impacts the hardest hit. So I just want to bring that point in here, that we take that seriously, and I would love to share with you further the story of one place who were not only resilient, but were successful in their preparation and continued efforts around climate change, Turkey Creek. So I want to invoke the spirit of the freed community of freed enslaved folks who established that Turkey Creek community and continues that energy today. And we are doing the same right here in Bayview Hunters Point. Thank you. Yeah, I don't want to. I want to make sure we're all balanced here. There are a couple slides here. So thank you for this time. We are Candlestick Point centric. It is the first urban state park, which is a real gift to the people, for the people, and by the people. Okay, but we have to remember that public space is one of those greatest equalizers. A lot of our work deals with environmental education. ecological literacy, you know, reading out our surroundings, understanding and ensuring that not only do vulnerable populations understand this, but they are represented within the field. They're in, you know, they are represented in leadership positions. And that is a slow culture that's happening in our very forward-thinking city. I'm a San Franciscan here. Half my life I've been born and raised here, and now I have children here. My hope is that they will stay here and actually put self-determination into practice. If we can go to this next slide here, it's showing the dream of actually the neighborhood that has maintained throughout almost four decades. This was a general plan of that first urban state park. There was Friends Up groups. There was that time where Black Horseback Rangers patrolled Candlestick Point State Park. We've gone a long way since then, but yet how do we bring that forward and connect it to climate change and being prepared? Part of that has to do with, of course, our workforce development and equitable opportunities to those work, you know, in within the field. I want to say we operate a native plant nursery, and that type of business is taking this deep ecological question and creating some revenue to invest right back in. We employ, you know, throughout the years, it's, I would say, well over a few hundred neighborhood residents within the field dealing with climate change preparedness. So that is one way, coupled with all the folks that I share this panel with on our strategies on how to not only achieve ecological balance, but also some social redemption.
Thank you very much for that, Anthony. So you all have really gotten a picture of some of what is happening along the Southeast waterfront, both from a climate perspective, but also from a people perspective, because as you can realize, people and the climate and the environment are all connected. And I'm going to bring Gerald back up for a Q&A.
Please join me in thanking Jackie Omotalade. And let me reintroduce her because I was in such a hurry to get her panel up there, I didn't properly introduce her. She's an attorney in town. She's also director of the Blue Greenway at the San Francisco Parks Alliance, so she's a heavy hitter in her own right. Okay. We would like to thank our listening audience. This is a program of the Commonwealth Club of California. The floor is now open for questions. Please keep your questions short. If you have a question, please come up behind the mic and feel free to ask the panel any question that you would like. Thank you.
Any questions? Please come to the microphone. Well, I will start it off, and I will ask David Bupre, what has been some of your, because you are one of the largest landowners along the Southeast waterfront, what have been some of your greatest challenges?
I think one of the largest challenges initially in kind of working with the Parks Alliance and the communities on planning the city project of the Blue Greenway was actually bringing together all the various agencies. Between 2008 and 2012, the port led Blue Greenway planning and design guidelines process. And if you think about the various city agencies, state agencies, and regional agencies, we were talking to one another. We were familiar with all the projects that were happening, but we weren't necessarily the best coordinated. So as a part of that process, the port and the city worked with our partners at the state and the region, Association of Bay Area Governments, Bay Conservation Development Commission, to say, let's all get on the same page. Let's all make certain that we're have the same vision for the Blue Greenway, and let's try to build a system that works for the user. So pulling those agencies together and continuing to coordinate with them so that really the user experience is single. You don't want to have to know that you have to call the port to go to Park A, Rec and Park to go to Park B, or the state to go to Park C. You just want to go to a park, or you just want to learn to find a way that you can reserve a picnic table to have a party or go out and enjoy nature. And so I think we've come a long way in being able to coordinate as various city and state agencies.
Thank you, David. Are there any questions?
Thank you for the panel. I found it very interesting. I did attend a previous presentation in a city agency about the plans for Candlestick Point state recreation area. And I understood at that presentation about that particular portion of the Blue Greenway that there was no plans to use any pesticides or herbicides in that area. My question is, in the larger area where you're speaking of the wetland restoration, if undervalued plants, which are sometimes called invasive species by some, enter into those areas, will pesticides or herbicides be used? And if so, what are the consequences for human and animal health? Thank you.
Anybody want to take that, Mark?
No.
Oh, okay. Elizabeth?
Yep. Well, you should speak for the state.
Well, I'm not sure about the specific plans for Yosemite Slough long term, but I wasn't actually aware that there were plans to not ever use any herbicides within Candlestick Point State Recreation Area. To my knowledge, we don't currently, and State Parks generally uses an integrated pest management approach for controlling invasive species. But if there are future plans to use herbicides, we certainly would involve the community in any decisions made on that. I don't know if there are specific plans for Yosemite Slough in the maintenance. Do you
want to speak to that? Sure, I can talk a little bit about that. So the plant palette for Yosemite Slough, in very tight coordination with our partners at Ledge, is intended to be native plants. And so since we essentially have a brand new landscape, we're planting an extensive palette of native plants. Most of those plants, in fact, are being grown by Ledge's eco-stewards, we're very pleased to say, and are coming from seed banks, which are, as Anthony alluded to, local seed banks. I don't think have really gotten to a place where we're beginning to talk yet about maintenance and operations of that landscape, but we have been in discussions amongst all of the nonprofit partners about us continuing to be engaged, both with volunteers but also with paid staff in making sure that whatever happens there has community engagement in a very serious way. We already have a champions team, which works at Candlestick. And that park champions team is a set of volunteers who come on a regular basis to Candlestick and are working in various places in the park. And, you know, Anthony should speak to his extraordinary program, both in terms of the native plants that they're growing, but also the way, in fact, that they've been engaged in maintenance and operations at the park.
Thank you for that nod, Elizabeth. Yeah, I got some big shoes, but I do have a lot of feathers in my hat, and I think that's a real asset. You know, the question that you brought up about how we manage our land is extremely important, especially in areas that are already overburdened by industrial pollutants. I think being innovative in how we manage the land takes a community perspective. And what I mean by that, you know, we throw that term around loosely. It takes folks who understand the usage of these lands and not just the planned usage. And currently, you know, looking at these areas and public access, you know, public health is of the most extreme concern, okay? And especially we're seeing a change of culture in connection to this. When we put the pressure, one of the greatest developments that has happened has been the EPA. You know, our protection agency, Region 9, has finally committed to, you know, full disclosure and finding a point source of pollution on Yosemite Slough. We're talking a lot about Yosemite Slough, which happens to be the largest tidal wetland restoration project currently in San Francisco. And once completed, will be the largest contiguous wetland in San Francisco. That's something really major in an area that historically The land use has not mimicked the needs of the community. So when we're looking at the picture of going back to the point around how we treat those undervalued plants, and I like the kind of how we use that jargon because all plants are good, right? Especially a man who operates a native plant nursery understands the ecological value of things. So taking that a step further and incorporating more people who have to deal with this in their backyard. How the Golden Gate National Recreation Area manages areas with public access, there's a gradient. And I think we need to really engage best practices from already well-established organizations and bring them over to this developing, amazing parcel of land.
Yes, the question in the back.
Yeah. Thank you. It's great to see
you. Can you speak into the mic, please?
Oh, sorry. It's great to see all of the habitat and wetland restoration that's happening here. And I'm just wondering if the panel knows of other places on the San Francisco shoreline, either where wetland restoration is occurring or where it might occur in places that maybe we haven't thought of yet.
Well, there are a lot of wetland restoration projects occurring, and I guess the distinction to make between the San Francisco shoreline, which was not historically a center for vast expanses of tidal marshes as was the South Bay or the North Bay, most of the projects going forward today are in those areas that have not been developed, have not been filled by urban development, et cetera. But the goal of there's an official program underway to restore tidal wetlands around the bay, and the goal is to restore over 100,000 acres of the original 200,000 acres of tidal wetlands that existed. And there's a pretty firm commitment to that. It's well underway now. There have been over 20,000 acres of tidal wetlands developed, and there's another 40,000 on the planning docks right now. So it's entirely achievable in a reasonable period of time.
David?
Just to add to that, there are two interesting projects happening right now that should be recognized. As one, the city of San Francisco just purchased property in India Basin, which was one of the last privately owned open spaces on the San Francisco Bay. And it's a partner project with the Port, Rec and Park, private developer called Build Inc., Lennar, and the Office of Community Investment and Infrastructure, as well as the Parks Alliance and the Trust for Public Land. And so this open space system is just in the very early stages of planning. Jackie can tell you how to get more information, but there is a look at how to expand on the success of what's happened at Heron's Head Park and create more wetlands, as well as what we couldn't get into, or I couldn't get into because of time constraints. But within Heron's Head Park, we are seeing some pretty significant areas of erosion that are starting to eat away at the park, and we're starting to investigate the opportunity of doing more of a living shoreline or a horizontal levee to provide some protection against both erosion and sea level rise, which is an opportunity for more habitat.
Underwater.
Can we explain just the term living shoreline for folks who might not know what that means?
In essence, shorelines can be protected from wave and tidal action through a variety of engineered solutions, ranging from a hard seawall that could be concrete or steel to riprap, which you see is rock engineered and placed along the shoreline. Or you could go with a more natural setting where you create a softer, gentler slope and plant it, and that can help address not only sea level rise, but storm action too. So it's a shoreline that's engineered because it needs to be designed, but it's not hard, it's soft.
Thank you. Matthew O'Grady, CEO of the San Francisco Parks Alliance.
Can't resist. So given this subject of adaptation and to ensure climate resiliency, particularly where San Francisco Bay is concerned, it warrants some brief discussion of a little-known government agency known as the Bay Restoration Authority and an opportunity that all of us as residents and voters in the Bay Area will have in June to have a very positive impact on San Francisco Bay. I wonder if one or more of the panelists might care to comment a little bit on that.
There's a measure on the ballot in June to assess if it passes a $12 parcel tax for all the residents of the 9-county Bay Area, which would create a fund of over a half a billion dollars to pay for the types of tidal marsh and other shoreline restorations that we've been discussing here today, both in urban and non-urban areas. The restoration authority has been established by state law to, should the measure pass, administer that. So not surprisingly, there are many who endorse this ballot measure. It's a reasonable amount of money, $12 per year per parcel. And so you'll have the opportunity, as the speaker just mentioned, to vote on that in early June.
Any other questions?
I have a question. When you talk about all the restoration of the wetlands and all that, the question comes to mind is what's the impact going to be on birds and fisheries? Because, you know, once that happens, I think nature responds. And as I know, because of the red tide or something, we can't get crab this year or whatever. But can you talk about bird and fishery response with all that good work you're doing?
You know, I'm gonna punt this one to Anthony because the port is the stewards of Heron's Head Park, but for a number of years, Literacy for Environmental Justice were our partners and managed the park. And Anthony was down there literally in the weeds, not using pesticides, and pulling the invasive species. And he can talk, I think, to both the birds and the butterflies
sure.
of Heron's Head
yeah.
Park.
Yeah, that's my business, but I do want to allow opportunities for the rest of our panelists here. I've had a lot of theory within the field, but also applied. And one of the benchmarks of all this restoration work is what happens once you do invest, you know, with this type. Like, what happens? You know, we also have to ground it in a geological timescale, right? And understand that these things happen maybe 50 years from now, 100 years from now. But anecdotal, you know, I want to say that there's been amazing response. All the way from, you know, the whole southeastern shoreline, you know, being that this was primarily fill, you know, with mixed usage, you know, along the whole shoreline. When you start opening up the hydrology for these sites, planting the indigenous species within there and then managing in a way that works with the ecology, I want to say amazing things do happen and benchmarks in restoration ecology. One of them in particular happened at Heron's Head Park. About 6 years ago in 2010, we had the return of a bird species, clapper rail bird species, Rallus langustris, you know. They change the names all the time, but that species, which was on the brink of extinction, that was a radio tag, returned to a wetland site. Okay, that formerly, you know, it was the terminus of a pier, you know, potentially the southern crossing to the East Bay, right? But with that in mind, it gives us a little hope along with the porpoises in the bay. But going back to your point, Gerald, around domoic acid, around your point of the impacts of climate change that we have to counteract, it's not just restore, but looking at these point sources that impact, the health of our fisheries, the health of our the land use that it surrounds these open mm-hmm. areas, and making sure that the neighborhood that also surround we are doing this in an urban setting, right? And I think that's what makes us so unique. So, yes, the clapper rail has returned to San Francisco, that bird species. Not to mention, I would say, the frequency and populations. I work in partnership with Golden Gate Audubon, which there was the talk around what other sites that maybe there's another question around that. Pier 94 is a phenomenal site that is kind of off the radar. I would consider it more of a refuge. And that's also in partnership with Golden Gate Audubon. Through avian census work that we do on an annual basis, you know, there has been species that have been observed and the frequency has been evolving. I want to say, that's better than, of course, numbers falling. And that's not always the case, though, okay? It's not all roses. Clapper rails do return, but many birds, many from the micro to the macro. There was a scientist friend of mine, Dr. Wayne, I used to walk with him in the wetlands, you know, and he's a microbiologist, right? And he cares about all that bacteria, okay? And the bacteria that is present in certain wetlands, right, that's the engineer, you know, of a lot of these sites. And without proper time on that geological time scale, and not to mention, you know, letting that run its course, we don't know. We don't know the success of the. I think it's too short, and there needs to be more investment. But we know that there is a response, from the community that we need these spots, and we need to invest in them more.
Question in the back.
I'm so excited to hear about the priority of community engagement. When you sort of look at the slides that have you've shown and the proximity to Bayview, that whole area, and Anthony, the pictures of, you know, kids getting involved and the concept of really having a sense of ownership. And there, you mentioned planting, you mentioned all of the original planting and certainly restoration that's going to occur. And I wonder about something that has sort of been talked about recently quite a lot, called creative placemaking. And the opportunity that it affords neighborhoods to really get engaged in the design and development process. And if you have any plans for art and creative involvement in the projects, not like the De Souvereau at Crissy Field, but more of a community and participatory engagement.
Elizabeth?
Yeah, and I want to talk a little bit about what we're engaged in at the moment. We very much, with the department, wanted to think about what kinds of programming and community engagement ought to be happening at both the Yosemite SLU portion of the park, but also in the balance of the park. And so we have begun a process which is going to be close to a year long, where many of the partners at the table, and many yet to come to the table, are going to be engaged in sort of designing, programming, and interpretation of the park. So we've been talking a lot about the physical changes that are happening in the place, but we haven't really talked about the way that people will learn and engage in them. And we've brought some extraordinary players into the room together to begin to talk about what the programming should look like here. What are the learnings that should happen? These places have so many layers of stories, not only sea level change and climate change. They have stories of the wetlands and the bay, the plants, the animals, but they also have extraordinary historic stories. So this was Butchertown, you know, the shipyard itself. These are the human stories of people who moved into this community and stayed and made the community that need to be told. And so we've really begun to think about community storytelling at this place. How do we get the people whose community this is to share their voices as the park begins to develop? This particular, the Yosemite SLU portion in particular, gets added to the park, but throughout the park, and have brought some really smart thinkers about brand new interpretive technology into the room to really work with community members to tell stories, because we don't want, you know, people who haven't lived these stories to tell them. We want the community to tell these stories, right? If somebody snuck onto the shipyard, as an old friend of mine did, at the age of 17, and told that she was, you know, actually of age to build ships during the Second World War. She should tell that story, right? That is an extraordinary story, and the community is rife with these stories. So capturing them, beginning to talk not only about the scientific base of this place, the natural base, but also the community engagement in place. So that will manifest itself in art. It will manifest itself in storytelling, we hope. It will manifest itself in the community engagement and making sure this place gets protected in the long term. So we've just begun that process, but we're really excited about it, and we're really hopeful that as Yosemite SLU comes online, that this will be a place where all of the extraordinary community making that Ledge has led the way on will expand exponentially.
Elizabeth, I'm just going to cut you off for 1 second because our podcast needs to end. We can continue on Q&A, but we actually at 7 o'clock, we need to end the podcast.
Yes. So I'm going to pass the mic. Let me read that last. So that was our last question. Our thanks to Jackie and her wonderful panel. We also thank the audience here as well as those listening to the recording. And now this meeting at the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.
Thank you. So we can go back into Q&A. And I think, David, you had to jump back in. Elizabeth, I apologize for cutting you off.
No.
I just wanted to add that, you know, the Blue Greenway is just not about the parks, the open space, and the systems. It's actually about the people and building stewardships and partnerships. And the port at Heron's Head Park is one example where we've partnered with Ledge in the past, and now we're partners with the Bay Institute and a variety of other organizations who operate our eco center. But there are elements of it that are cultural, that are environmental and historical, and we're trying to get public art as a part of the process. One of the latest projects the port has done is Bayview Rise, which is maybe the largest and tallest public art project on the old Islays Creek grain silos. If you want to go to sfport.bayviewrise, you can see it, or if you're anywhere in the eastern side of the city at night, you can see it, and it lit up the skyline. Plus, we have six different advisory groups up and down the waterfront where we invite our neighbors, our tenants, our interested stakeholders to participate in all of our planning. They meet on a monthly basis. And so we truly try to engage with the community as much as possible. As I mentioned before, the Crane Cove Park design went through 30-plus meetings. When we did the overall Pier 70 plan, it was in excess of 300 public meetings to engage the community. So we're all ears and want to engage with the community as much as we can.
Okay, question in the back.
Oh, can I add on to that
Yes. Real
briefly?
I just wanted to add that the governor's proposed budget for next fiscal year that was released in January included a two-year pilot community engagement project at both Candlestick Point SRA and Los Angeles State Historic Park. And this project includes new community liaisons that will work with community-based organizations and nonprofit groups to create culturally relevant interpretive programs. So I just wanted to mention that proposal in the governor's budget that hopefully will come to fruition.
Question in the back.
Thank you. And I saw that job announcement. That's really exciting for folks, for the park. So I just wanted to ask an overarching question. Thank you for this terrific panel, incredible diversity of perspectives and expertise and background. I think about how wonderful Anthony and Patrick's program is and how integrated it is in terms of the social ecology mission. And I think about how can we export that, you know, bring it up the shoreline of the eastern shoreline, the whole along the whole Blue Greenway. I know, you know, we can't restore the whole shoreline, and we can do some living shorelines here and there. But there is all this new technology with the horizontal levees and all. So I just want us to think about and you know, ask if we can contemplate more how to really take that incredible model and make it place based in as many places as we can along the shore.
So does anybody want to respond to that?
Yeah, I mean, I can briefly, I'm going to try to be cogent here. I ponder that a lot. I think it's a, you know, I mentioned this many times tonight and numerous times throughout my lifetime, but resources, you know, and following those. Ecologically speaking, southeastern San Francisco has extreme ecological value. As far as, you know, tidal wetland estuarine habitat. Paired with that, extreme historical and social value in the fact that these are neighborhoods. These are people living here for generations. They have a tie. With the fact that we, as a city, manage this parcel of land and jurisdictional boundaries, that is an institutional barrier to allocating resources to a region that is desperately in need of it. And what I mean by that, let me give one example, and I'm trying to be cogent here. State bill that Mark Leno authorized back in 2009, $50 million transfer of land, okay, from Candlestick Point State Recreation Area to the city of San Francisco, $50 million. And just where does that all fall? I feel like so that we can get the stage of co-powerment, Peter, somehow we have to follow that and ensure that we can continue to be as just one of the many. You know, I don't want to put all the spotlight on just one community-based organization in the region, even though I feel like we've done our due diligence. do not want to put the spotlight on us only. I want to say there's others out there. They're in desperate need. And it's extremely competitive to get that investment from all branches of you know, public and private sector. So that was just one example on resources. I want to see maybe looking at the angle of, you know, maybe from Mark, you know, thinking about in regards to Baylen goals for tidal wetland restoration. Is there, you know, how do we allocate the inequities or disparities within that? So that we can ensure that we prioritize these vulnerable communities.
How does that bring to the community perspective?
Yeah, I mean, please, Ms. Harrison, if
no, you're doing well.
I don't like putting the spotlight on one community-based organization, but I want to say we are in a unique perspective, and I want to open it up to the larger, picture of everything. Yeah.
You know, one of the things that I can honestly say that through
Ms. Murray, can you speak into the mic?
Oh, excuse me. Thank you. One of the things that I can honestly say that through the whole process of restoring our shoreline, and in particular, one of the amazing things that happened with Heron's Head was that they used our children. You'd be surprised how much they learn, and then you would also be very surprised at how talented they are. Yes, their parents and their grandparents have history, 4 and 5 generations worth of people being there, but those children, those young folks, have taken their talent and their interest, and they've worked on something, and they love coming back and teaching other young folks, people younger than them, we worked on this, we did this, this is what this plant's going to do, this is why we planted it. This plant was indigenous to our city and our state. And it's important that you, when you're doing these things in any community, not just Bayview, but any community, you need to engage the population. If you do not engage the population, you end up with an area that might be beautiful, clean, but not used because the community, the surrounding community, feel that they were left out. My job is to make sure that community folks are not left out. My job is to make sure that not only are they not left out, but after the fact, that they get to engage in what's going to happen after you clean it, after you design it, after you put all these wonderful things there, where do we stand? And I represent and work with a lot of community folks, in particular in Bayview, that are very, they live below the poverty line. People don't tend to pay them any attention, and you need to. They have history to tell. I work with folks whose fathers, grandfathers, literally worked in that shipyard when it was actually functioning. They could tell you stories that you would not believe that of things that they did. They could tell you how much of that shipyard was filled in. It was landfill, and you do realize that that whole area from Ennis on out is basically landfill. Most of the shipyard is landfill. So if history is what you're looking for, you need to really look inside yourself and realize we can't get that through a book. We need to engage the surrounding community. So if I pushed anything, I'd like to push the fact that the surrounding community literally has a lot of talent, a lot of information. I like the fact that when Anthony was working, when they were working on Heron's Head Park, they went into the schools. Most folks don't do that anymore. We engage, I try to engage from grammar school on up because I discovered that I did a sea level rise training for fifth graders a year ago. I was walking down 3rd Street and 2 young ladies walking with their mother, I believe it was their mother, said, "Oh, that's Ms. H. I'm keeping my pledge." And I'm going, "Oh God, what was the pledge? I don't remember what the pledge was 2 years ago. What was the pledge?" Well, you know, little things like she said, "See?" And she showed me her water bottle. "We don't buy that other stuff. We bring our own." And the little girl beside her says, "I turn out all my lights every time I leave the room. I don't do." And I'm going, "Well, good." And so her mother goes, "Are you the one who started this mess in my house?" And I go, "Oh my God, what did I do?" But the fact is that the younger they are, the more you know, if you get them caught up in it, you'll find that they will be your best assets. Now, these young ladies literally taunt their mother every time she leaves out and leaves the television going, runs the water. Why are you washing such a small load of clothes? We have a line in our backyard and you're not using it, you know. And all of this because they want to help save this world. Not just Bayview, they want to save this world. And these are fifth graders. Can you imagine the intelligence and the talent when you start going into the high school students? And then from there you go into the college students. I work with them all, and I honestly, I have seen some of the most beautiful minds. I just want you to experience that when you start planning on what happens next. Not just give me a job to get out there and work and, you know, clean it up and tell you what I want it to look like. But I want to be able to come back, and those are your storytellers.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Hmm.
Any one final question from anyone? If not, thank you so much. Mm-hmm. Thank you to the panelists. Thank you. Thank you.